supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Sterobin. On Grapple so far, we've been hearing personal stories and reflections from people living and working in distressed communities. And it's made us wonder, what is the American dream, who participates in it, and how has it changed over time? Turns out Robert Putnam has written a whole book about this idea. It's called Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. Putnam is a political scientist at Harvard University. His other books include Bowling Alone, which explores the importance of social networks and how they've changed in American society. Robert Putnam is joining us now from the studios of Harvard University in Boston. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you very much, Naomi. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
So to start off with, this phrase, the American dream, when you think of that, what comes to mind? How would you define it?
The fundamental equality of all of us and the fact that how will you do in life should depend upon you and your own native talents and your own hard work, but should not depend upon what your parents did or didn't do. That core idea has been the guiding thread of American public philosophy for more than 200 years. And the question is that any longer true? Americans have historically not worried so much about the distribution of income across people in the end. We've figured, well, if everybody's getting on the ladder at the same point and some people climb higher, that's probably because they're better climbers or they work harder at it. But that's on the assumption that we're all getting on the ladder at the same point. Some of us don't have a head start because of where we come from or the color of our skin or our gender. And that idea is my definition of the American dream. If we all have a roughly equal opportunity to do with our own skills and talents what we will, that's the kind of society I want to live in.
And you've done some looking into how optimistic people are about the American dream. How has that changed over time? How optimistic are people today about this?
Well, they're more optimistic than they should be, but they're less optimistic than they used to be. That is to say, Americans have historically overperceived how easy it is actually to climb the ladder. But they are now less optimistic than they were 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years ago about the chances for upward mobility. And they're absolutely right. That change, which I'm describing in statistics, they're seeing in the lives of themselves and their families and their kids.
And in your book, Our Kids, you open up talking about a place you grew up, Port Clinton, Ohio on Lake Erie, and you describe how your hometown in the 1950s was, I think you call it, a passable embodiment of the American dream. And then you go on to say that today it's more like a split-screen American nightmare. Well, those are very strong words, so please explain what happened.
Well, first of all, let me be sure that I describe accurately, you've quoted me accurately, but that I describe accurately what Port Clinton was like in the 1950s. Port Clinton's a small little town. When I was growing up in the 1950s, nobody very rich, nobody very poor. And the people in my high school graduating class, 80% of us have done better than our parents. And the most striking thing is the people from the wrong side of the tracks back in the 1950s have done just about as well as the people from the right side of the tracks. Of course, there was racism. This was the 1950s. And there was gender bias, for sure. But in terms of social class bias, that was a pretty equal place. In fact, the distance between the home of the richest kid in my class, and actually the richest kid in town, and one of the poorest kids in my class was 5 blocks. We all played on the same little league teams, and we went to the same high school, and most kids in Port Clinton in those years went to church, and they didn't all go to either one rich church or one poor church. But now, 60 years later, you go back to Port Clinton, it's very economically segregated. And there's a road in Port Clinton called East Harbor Road. You drive down that road parallel to the shore, and if you look to the left, the whole shoreline there for 20 miles is essentially one gated community of million-dollar mansions. But just on the other side of the road, where the kids come from very poor homes, the child poverty rate in that census tract is 50%. And nevertheless, you can see in this one little town what's happened in America. The kids from the two sides of East Harbor Road have completely different futures.
Can you talk about what happened, you know, in the 1970s and beyond, where we started to see manufacturing going away, shifts in population, shifts in the job market, that had an impact on the American dream and an impact on all of the things you describe, obviously.
Well, I'd say there are three big changes, and you can see all three of them in Port Clinton. That's why I talk about Port Clinton, not because it's the most important town in America. It clearly isn't, but because even in this little town, you can see all these big changes. Change number one, that is a growing income gap between rich families and poor families in America. People in the more affluent part of our society and economy have done just great over the last 30 or 40 years, and that's the people who live out on the shoreline that I was talking about in Port Clinton. But people from about the median income down effectively haven't had a real raise in constant dollars, haven't had a real raise in 20 or 30 years. And that meant there's this growing gap between what's financially available to affluent families, well-educated families, and what's available to poor families. The second, less well-known, but actually probably just as important, is that there's been growing segregation of American society, so that increasingly rich families are living only around other rich families. I say rich, I don't mean Bill Gates. I'm talking about people with a college education. So the upper third of American society, or affluent Americans, are increasingly living in enclaves with other affluent educated Americans. And at the other end, increasingly less educated, high school educated people. And again, I'm not talking about the poorest of the poor. I'm talking about what we used to call the working class. They're increasingly concentrated in poor enclaves. And that has huge effects because it affects the kind of schools kids go to. Rich kids are increasingly concentrated in schools with other rich kids, and those are very successful schools. And poor kids are increasingly concentrated in poor schools, in schools with other poor kids. And those schools are not only low income, but they're also lower performing. It affects who our kids know. Affluent kids are much less likely today to know anybody whose dad or mom is a manual worker. Whereas when you're growing up in Port Clinton in the 1950s, most of my friends, actually, my dad was a small businessman, but most of my friends were people whose dads worked with their hands. And thirdly, the third big change is that there was strong, what I call social capital, strong sense of community and ties, and families were strong and they helped one another. And across America, that kind of social connectedness and family and community bonds has rapidly deteriorated in poor communities, in large part because of the economic disaster, and has not deteriorated in affluent communities. Only about 9% of kids in those homes are living with a single parent. But at the same time, among what we used to call the working class, that is high school educated Americans, the rate of kids living in single parent homes has gone from about, 5% back in the 50s and 60s to now almost 70%. More than two-thirds of all kids of all races in America growing up in working-class homes today are growing up with a single parent, mostly a mom. The families are very fragmented and very fragile, and those kids today in Port Clinton don't have the same kind of support as kids now, really just on the other side of the road along the shoreline, where they're almost all the families out there are two-parent families.
And this all speaks to really one of the key questions in the book, which is about equal life chances. Do children from different socio and economic backgrounds have equal life chances? And I can see which way you're leaning.
They don't have equal life chances. And, you know, let's be realistic. They've never had perfectly equal life chances. But it's not just there is a gap between the opportunities and resources available to rich kids and poor kids. That gap has rapidly grown in the last 20 or 30 years, rapidly grown. And that is leading us, I don't want to be sort of crying wolf and saying, oh, things are going to hell in a handbasket. But the fact is, we are moving gradually, but I fear inexorably, toward a hereditary class society in which the most important decision you make is choosing your parents. And if you choose well, and I'm saying it ironically, because of course nobody chooses their parents. And the whole point of our society was it shouldn't depend upon your parents. It should depend upon you. And can I just take a step back and look at the question historically? Because America has faced this very same challenge at earlier points in our history. About 115 years, 120 years ago, the so-called Gilded Age, at the end of the 19th century, there were huge gaps between rich and poor, as big in 1890 as they ever would be again in American history until now. And high rates of immigration then, and high rates of political alienation, a sense then that the major political parties were not helping us fix our problems. Don't know if that sounds familiar, but there are a lot of parallels between America in the 1890s and America today. And then America recognized the problem and turned a corner and began to fix it and successfully did make serious progress. That's my inspiration for actually being pretty optimistic about what we can do now. And then I'll talk about exactly what policies we might perform. But I want to say this. This is not mainly a problem of policy wonkery. What policies would work? I've got a dozen policies that would work. It's mainly a problem of politics getting us to focus together on this problem.
Let's go to the fix in a second. I just want to ask a quick question because I hear political leaders say a lot, if you work hard and play by the rules, you can be successful in the United States. And maybe that was true. I'm sensing from you and many other places that perhaps it's not true anymore.
Yeah, that's right. There are a number of things that have happened. One is that affluent folks, educated folks, because we are no longer in as much contact with people from the other side of the tracks, we're just less aware of what life is actually like today. And we have this false impression of our own growing up that, well, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. Why can't these kids do it? And that reflects a fundamental misperception of how the world has changed. And that applies as well to political leaders. I think it's now the case that over the last couple of years has become at least more verbal attention to this problem, actually on both sides of the aisle politically, than there used to be. And that's for the good. And in principle, in a well-functioning political system, it's exactly the kind of problem that you could sort of sit down around a table and have, you know, Republicans and Democrats say, well, we all agree that all of these kids ought to have a fair chance. And I think we ought to do X, and somebody else says, I think we ought to do Y. And so you end up with a compromise in which you do some X and some Y. At the moment in national politics, that's not where we are. We're not in a world politically in which you can imagine reasonable people sitting down around a table in some congressional committee room and working out a deal that would begin to address the problem seriously. And until we get to that kind of a national politics in which people are focused on solving the problem of kids and not just on political slogans, I think it's going to be hard to solve the problem nationally, despite the rhetoric about working hard and playing by the rules. It just isn't true anymore that if you work hard and play by the rules, everything will work out fine. That is not true anymore, and we've got to make it true. We ought to be able to solve this problem. And as I say, I think at the local level, we may still have enough sense of shared obligation to kids that as I travel around the country, I do see quite encouraging signs that in a number of local communities and states, people are beginning to move beyond lip service to figuring out practically, okay, so what do we do here to solve our version of this larger problem?
So what do we do now? Give us the top areas where policy changes could really make a difference.
We should do something about ending wage stagnation, and that means things like minimum wage or the earned income tax credit. We should do something about family structure and family support, and that means things like expanded family leave and home visiting, that is providing coaching in parenting to moms and dads who, for whatever reason, didn't experience good parenting in their own childhood. We could do something for low-income schools. We could do a lot more in providing mentoring for these kids who are living really mostly on their own wits. We should worry about vocational technical education, community colleges. But if I had just one wish, what I'd do is make high-quality early childhood education universal across America. The experts know that high-quality early childhood education works, and the payback is remarkable. There's still some political debate about it, but in fact, financial support for early childhood education is spreading pretty rapidly across the country. And it's not a matter of liberal-conservative. The most comprehensive state-level program in early childhood education is actually in Oklahoma, one of the reddest states in America. And my research team pulled together nearly 50 of the best experts in the country and produced a report. You can get it at something called theopportunitygap.com. And it is just saying, if you want to close the opportunity gap, here's what you need to know from the best experts in the country about solutions that will work in early childhood education, in K-12, in community colleges, in neighborhood development, and so on.
Robert Putnam is a political scientist at Harvard University and the author of Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Thank you, Bob, for taking time to join us today.
Thanks very much, Naomi. It was great talking with you.
That wraps up our show. You can find our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Grapple is a co-production of Covenda Media and Keystone Crossroads, a public media initiative covering both the challenges and solutions for distressed cities. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to WHYY's Al Banks for engineering our show and to Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Kumenda Media, and I'm Naomi Sturobin, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.